Good afternoon, and thanks, everyone, for coming. I'm just going to get the PowerPoint up and running here. As you may know, this year is an auspicious year in the history of science. It's the 200th anniversary of the birth of Charles Darwin, and the 150th anniversary, coming up later in November, of the publication of The Origin of Species. And there are events planned in universities and colleges all around the country. There's a great discussion that's emerged about the legacy of Darwin. And I had the opportunity in February to actually speak in what I thought from the map was Shrewsbury, his birthplace, but I learned when I was there it's pronounced Shrewsbury. Okay, it's a British thing. Anyway, when I was in Britain and speaking about the legacy of Darwin, I also learned that his legacy is being commemorated this year in the United Kingdom. We have the Queen on one side of the £10 note and Charles Darwin on the other. So there's quite a lot of worldwide interest in just this question. What is Charles Darwin's legacy? What has he left us? What has he taught us? And there are many things that have come into Western science because of Darwin. One is something that I appreciate very much, which is a very rigorous method of studying the remote past. He actually pioneered a method of historical scientific investigation. He also gave us the idea of natural selection. He had a theory about the history of life. But in most intellectual histories of Darwin, it's generally agreed that the primary thing he established, or the primary thing he showed, was that there is no evidence of design in biology, that his primary legacy is that he refuted the design argument. And I have a brief quotation here that conveys this from Francisco Ayala, who is the past president of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. And Ayala says this. He says, "The functional design of organisms and their features would seem to argue for the existence of a designer. But it was Darwin's greatest accomplishment to show that the directive organization of living things could be explained as the result of a purely natural process, natural selection, without any need to resort to a creator or any other external agent." So Darwin shows that, as Ayala has put it more recently, you have design without a designer. You have the appearance of design without real design. Now, this is the classical and still current Darwinian perspective. And as a result of this, the consensus around this among many in evolutionary biologists, there have been other ideas advanced, extensions of this idea. One biologist says that this denial of design is the foundation of the worldview in the West of scientific materialism. That's Douglas Fatuma, who's written a prominent evolutionary biology textbook. This idea of materialism, or that it goes closely with the idea of the denial of design, has emboldened a group of scientists who now have the title the New Atheists. And they made quite a splash in the media in 2006, 2007, because of their unparalleled success in publishing a number of books, one by Richard Dawkins called The God Delusion, another by Daniel Dennett called Breaking the Spell, the spell being religion. And the argument in these books was basically that science has disproven the existence of God, or at least rendered belief in God incredible. And the argument would run something like this. The design argument has always been the most compelling reason to believe in God. After Darwin, we know there is no evidence of design. Therefore, belief in God is tantamount to a delusion. We may not be able to disprove it with absolute certainty, but as Dawkins says, belief in God is very, very, very improbable. Okay. Now, the premise in this argument is that there is no evidence of design. And while the New Atheists take that in a kind of in-your-face, overt, radical direction, that premise is shared by a lot of scientists still today, although, as I'm going to show, there's reasons to doubt it. Now, why is that conviction that there is no evidence of design in biology so widespread, or why has it been so widespread, such that people credit Darwin, this as being Darwin's central legacy? Well, here's the Darwinian perspective in a nutshell. It comes from Richard Dawkins. He says that biology is the study of complicated things that give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose. We have some student-looking people here today, so I'll give a quiz. What's the key word in this quotation from the Darwinian point of view? Appearance. Okay, it's appearance. Exactly right. All biologists agree that living things have complicated organization. Many think that organization looks as though it were designed. And here Dawkins affirms the same thing. But he's saying that appearance is illusory. It's not real. Now, why does he say that? He says that because from the Darwinian point of view, the appearance of design in living organisms has resulted from an undirected process, natural selection acting on random variations, with the emphasis on natural and random, purely undirected process that can mimic the powers of a designing intelligence without itself being designed or guided in any way. That's classical Darwinian thought. It's reaffirmed by the modern neo-Darwinists. Richard Dawkins is perhaps its primary spokesman for this point of view, but it's a very common point of view. Now, the question I want to ask today is whether or not this is actually correct. Is every appearance of design in biology the result of a purely undirected process, such that we can safely say that the appearance of design is illusory? Let's put that question in some perspective. This is Darwin's famous tree of life. It's his representation of the history of life. It captures his idea that all the living forms today, which are represented by the branches at the top of the tree, ultimately descended by a slow, gradual, undirected process from earlier, simpler forms of life, going all the way back to the first primordial organism. So you could think of that first organism changing a little tiny bit and gradually morphing into new forms over millions and millions and indeed billions of years. Now, according to Darwin, Darwin's theory explains, he asserts, every appearance of design that arises after the origin of life itself to the present time. So you could think of the coiled nautilus, you could think of the eye of the in a mammalian species, you could think of the pressure sensors in a giraffe's neck, all these extraordinary features of living systems that have arisen since the origin of life have arisen as the result of natural selection acting on random mutations of various kinds, producing these appearances of design. But again, that's an illusion because we have this unguided process guiding, not guiding, but producing the whole panoply of living organisms. Now, there's debate within biological circles, perhaps a suppressed debate, submerged debate, but there is debate about whether or not this assertion is correct. There are scientists now who question whether Darwin's theory can produce all the complex forms that we see in the history of life, and in particular, whether Darwin's theory can produce the nanotechnology, the complexity that we see at the cellular level, and the intricate body plans that arise in events like the Cambrian explosion or the mammalian radiation. But that's not the debate I'm going to talk about today. I'm going to do, as lawyers say, concede for the sake of argument, do the ad arguendo move. And I'm going to say, let's set that debate about the sufficiency of Darwin's theory aside. And let's look at another more fundamental question. We're going to look at the question of the origin of life, another potential loci or occasion where design might have played a role in the history of life. And we're going to ask whether or not there's any evidence of design there, or whether we, again, have merely the appearance of design or maybe no appearance of design whatsoever. And I'm going to be talking about what's at the very base of the tree, what's represented by the base of the tree in the Darwinian picture of the history of life, and that is the origin of the very first life itself. That's a question that Darwin never addressed, and oddly, in 150 years, though people have tried, it's generally conceded that no one has succeeded in providing an undirected evolutionary explanation for how that life began. So do we have perhaps evidence of design at that point in the history of life? Well, in the 19th century, people didn't worry too much about that question. They didn't have an answer for it. They had no explanation for the origin of the first life. Darwin himself was quite explicit about that he didn't propose one in The Origin of Species, nor was he capable of providing one, though he did offer a few admitted speculations about the topic. But people in the 19th century, scientists in the 19th century, were not very worried about the absence of such an evolutionary explanation because they assumed that the cell was exceedingly simple. I love this quotation because it makes me feel so smart. It's from Thomas Henry Huxley, 1869. He's Darwin's famous bulldog, one of the leading evolutionary biologists of the 19th century, and he captured the view of life at its most fundamental level in 1869, he said the cell is a simple homogeneous globule of plasm. Okay, translated jello or goo. Those are the non-scientific terms that capture the idea. And the idea there is you've got the cell is made of a few simple chemicals, and because of that, you could readily imagine a very few simple chemical reactions from simple compounds combining and recombining and producing this protoplasmic substance that was assumed to be the essence of life in the 1860s and 1870s. Now, that view gradually began to change, but it changed dramatically beginning in the 1950s. And beginning with what is now called the molecular biological revolution, there was a dramatic change in our understanding of how complex life is at this most fundamental and allegedly simple level. The key discovery in this period of time was, of course, Watson and Crick's discovery of the structure of the DNA molecule. They elucidated the double helix structure of DNA, and they cracked a long-standing mystery, the mystery of the origin, the mystery of where biological information resides. Where is the information that is responsible for hereditary traits in the cell? Where does it reside? Where is it stored? The helix was a very exciting discovery, the structure, but what was even more exciting, and Watson and Crick intimated this in 1953 in their first paper, was that the helix had a structure that lent itself to the storage of information. Now, Crick picked up on that idea in 1957 with something called the sequence hypothesis, and I actually think this is perhaps the most bold conjecture in the history of biology. It's certainly one of the most significant discoveries. Its confirmation led to this molecular biological revolution I was talking about. The sequence hypothesis was simply the idea that along the spine of the DNA molecule, running on the interior of the molecule and the longitudinal axis there, where you see the A's, C's, G's, and T's depicted. Crick suggested that those chemicals, those A's, C's, T's, and G's called bases, function just like alphabetic characters in a written language or digital characters in a section of software. And at the time, he speculated that the instructions stored by those characters, those chemical characters, had something to do with the construction of proteins, which were at nearly the same time also being elucidated and studied carefully. In 1958, a man named John Kendred first discovered that the protein myoglobin had an extraordinary three-dimensional structure. And here I have a little visual aid that will assist our scientific discussion. These are snap-lock blocks. It says on the box from which I stole them that they are for students ages 2 to 4. In any case, they'll assist nicely here. We now know today that proteins are made of long chains of smaller molecules called amino acids, and I'm representing them with these colorful beads. When amino acids are linked together, they exert forces on one another and cause intricate three-dimensional structures to arise. In 1958, when Kendrew elucidated the structure of myoglobin, whale myoglobin, he made an extraordinary discovery, which was the proteins, which were long thought to be simple, repetitive structures, actually had very intricate, complex three-dimensional shapes. And it was determined that these three-dimensional shapes, in turn, result from the very specific arrangements of amino acids. Amino acids are linked up in the right way. They exert forces on each other that create three-dimensional shapes. Now, the even more interesting discovery about proteins is that these three-dimensional shapes are absolutely essential for the jobs that proteins perform. You could kind of think of it as like the toolbox out in your garage. You have a saw, a hammer, a wrench, pliers. Each one of those tools performs a function, and the function it performs is closely related to the shape of the tool itself. You can't pound very well with a saw. You can't cut very well with a hammer. The shape of the tool is important for its job. Well, the same thing is true with proteins. These intricate three-dimensional shapes actually are crucial to the functions they perform, because they will fit hand and glove like with other molecules to to catalyze reactions, to form structural parts of larger machines, to be parts of the machines that process information. So this three-dimensional structure is critical. What Crick anticipated was that the instructions on the DNA molecule had something to do with the construction of those proteins. And it turns out that he was right. And in fact, we have a little animation that shows exactly what was discovered in the period called the molecular biological revolution. Many scientific hypotheses are confirmed with a single experiment. Crick's took many years to establish that he was correct. Now, this is the DNA molecule. You see the tightly wound strands with the A's, G's, and T's represented in the middle. This is a little animation showing the molecule being unwound, separated, so that it can be copied by this large molecular machine called a polymerase. Now, this is a view of the inside of the polymerase as the process of what's called gene expression proceeds. This is a copy of the DNA message being made at the polymerase. There it's coming off very fast on the right, and now that's going to move towards the outer part of the cell, going through a little gated porthole called the nuclear pore complex. In Washington, in civics class, you learn how a bill becomes a law. This is how a gene becomes a protein, the DNA information directs protein synthesis. So here's the information passing through this gated porthole out of the nucleus. It's going to go to essentially a molecular factory called a ribosome. It's a two-part factory that collapses on top of this transcript. And now that's the transcript of information is going to be threaded through, and an assembly line then ensues where the DNA, or the copy of the DNA called messenger RNA, and on the top is going to direct the construction of a growing chain of amino acids. And depending on the arrangement of those amino acids, you'll get one protein or another. And you can see it actually takes place very rapidly. Here's the ribosome from another view. The spent transcript is coming off the top, and the protein is there at the bottom, and it begins its process of folding. The folding process is even more intricate. It often goes off to another barrel-shaped machine called a chaperone, where it nestles into precise grooves. Again, great specificity of fit, and then is folded properly at the chaperone. I think the animator will have it light up when it gets in the right configuration. There we go. Boom, we've got a protein now, and then off it goes out into the cytoplasm, the outer part of the cell, to do its job. And an intricate, intricate process. And this is what was elucidated by Watson and Crick, or not by Watson and Crick, in the wake of Watson and Crick's discovery by the community of molecular biologists in the 1950s and 60s. And we're learning more about it all the time. Even though this looks complex in the animation, in many ways this is just a cartoon version of the complexity of this intricate information processing system. And one of the really extraordinary things about this is that not only is there information on DNA, but the information on DNA is used to build the proteins, which in turn are involved in the processing of that information on the DNA. So you have a classic engineering closed loop. It's an extraordinary system. So I said at the beginning, or just a minute ago, that Watson and Crick cracked a mystery. They cracked the mystery of the structure of the DNA molecule. But that's not the mystery I want to talk about today. The mystery I want to talk about today I call the DNA enigma. It's not the structure of the DNA molecule. Watson and Crick did a great job of solving that mystery. It's not even the question of where biological information resides. We now have a good idea of that as well. There's digital code stored along the spine of the DNA molecule. It's not even what the information in DNA does. We just saw an animation that illustrates roughly what that information does do. The mystery that I call the DNA enigma, the deeper mystery, is the mystery of where that information came from. It's the question of the origin of the information in DNA. And that is closely linked to another long-standing mystery in biology, and that's the mystery we mentioned at the beginning of the lecture, the mystery of the origin of life. One origin of life biologist puts it this way. He says, the problem of the origin of life is basically equivalent to the problem of the origin of biological information. Now, if we think about that for a minute, it makes good sense. I used to ask my students, if you want to give your computer a new function, what do you have to give it? Software, code. It's, in our information age, this is an obvious answer. The same thing is true in biology. If you want to build a new structure from a pre-existing structure, you want to build a new organism from a pre-existing organism, you need new proteins. Therefore, you need new lines of digital code on the DNA. But at an even more primary level, if you want to get life going in the first place, if you want to build the first cell, you have to give an account of where the information came from that runs the show in biology. DNA, and we now know other forms of information, are absolutely central to the function of living organisms. So where does that information come from? If you want to explain the origin of life, you've got to explain what life is, how it works, what we know about it. And what we know is that information does run the show in biology. And so that's the central question. Now, this question I call the DNA enigma. In the first line of my book, I start by saying, when Watson and Crick elucidated the structure of DNA, they solved one mystery, but they created another. And the mystery they created I call this DNA enigma. I first encountered this mystery in 1985. I was a young scientist at the time, working in the field of digital signal processing in the oil industry. I was a geophysicist looking for all out in the guff, as the Texans, my Texan bosses said. And a conference came to Dallas, where I was working. And it was really a world-class conference on the big questions in science, the origin of the universe, the origin of life, the nature of human consciousness. And the conference featured scientists who were from a materialistic philosophical perspective and those of a non-materialistic or perhaps theistic perspective, squaring off, giving different interpretations of the scientific data on these key questions. And I became fascinated with the panel on the origin of life. I knew really very little about the topic at the time. I assumed that evolutionary theory had this issue pretty well sewn up, that everything had been explained. But there was a scientist on the panel who shocked everyone by announcing that his own, leading theory of how life had first emerged from the primordial ooze, the molecules, the first cell idea, was incorrect. His name was Dean Kenyon. He had written a book called Biochemical Predestination, which was, at the time, the leading college-level textbook, advanced-level book on this subject. And he announced that his idea, that he no longer believed his idea and that he repudiated it there. Another scientist then spoke who had just written a book called The Mystery of Life's Origin. His name is Charles Thaxton. You see his picture on the screen. And he gave a point-by-point critique of the different theories of the origin of life that were then in currency and showed that they had multiple problems. And in particular, they could not solve the problem of the origin of biological information. Now, what surprised me was that many of the scientists on the panel, in fact, almost all, agreed with many of the points of his critique. And there was really no dispute about whether or not the field of what I learned to call origin of life biology or chemical evolutionary theory was in a state of impasse. And one of the reasons for that was something that Thaxton clarified at the time, and that has to do with the nature of the information in DNA, or the nature, some people talk about the ordering of those bases, those A's, C's, G's, and T's. And what Thaxton pointed out was that the ordering of those bases is not just any old kind of order. The bases are arranged, would be a better way to put it, but they're not in a simple order like ABC, ABC, or the kind of order you find in a crystal with NaCl, the two chemical elements repeating in a perfectly redundant way. Instead, what you have inside the cell is a non-repeating order, not like the sequence on top, which you might call random or something that is merely complex, but rather like the sequence on the bottom, where the arrangement is critical to the function of the sequence. The term that was used at the conference and has been used since is the idea of specified complexity. The arrangement is not just complex, it's complex and specified so that it performs a function. And this, Thaxton argued, was the kind of arrangement of characters or the kind of information that you have in DNA. And that was the critical thing that had to be explained. That was a central part of the DNA enigma. Now, why is that so mysterious? Well, in part because that's exactly the kind of string of characters that we have in a written language or in a computer code. And Richard Dawkins himself has acknowledged this by noting that the genes, the DNA, the information in DNA, is like a machine code. He said the machine code of the genes is uncannily computer-like. Bill Gates, our local hero out in Seattle, in Redmond, Washington, says that DNA is like a computer program, but far more advanced than any we've ever created. So we have clearly a striking appearance of design. When we're talking about information that is functionally specified in this way, we're talking about something which, in our experience, is almost, well, is entirely the result of, always the result of, an intelligent agency. So we have an appearance of design, and yet, at this point at least, or at that point, at the conference when I was first learning about it, no unguided processes that can explain that appearance. And that really set me on something of an intellectual adventure, because I wanted to know if there was there were, in fact, solutions to this mystery. Could this be explained from within the standard evolutionary framework? A year later, I found myself in graduate school at Cambridge University in the philosophy of science, and I began to work on this question of the origin of life. And I found that the mystery was indeed very profound, and in fact, what I found was that every attempt to solve the mystery of the origin of the information that you need to build life just had the effect of deepening the mystery. And there was a famous book written by a colleague of Francis Crick called Chance and Necessity, written by Jacques Monod, famous French molecular biologist. And he said just something that's fairly non-controversial for many scientists, which is that if you're going to be a scientist, you want to explain something, you have a few basic tools. You can try to explain things by reference to random or chance processes, you can invoke natural laws or forces of necessity. If we drop something and it falls to the ground, physicists would describe that motion with the law of gravity. Monod would say that object has fallen by necessity in a law-like way. So that's his idea. Use chance, use laws, or the combination of the two. And so most of the attempts to explain the origin of information have fallen along those lines. And as I begin to examine the different categories, the different attempts, the different approaches to explaining the origin of information, what I found was that the mystery was a very profound one indeed, and that every attempt to solve it actually deepened it. And let me just sketch some of the, in a kind of rough and ready way, some of the problems that scientists have encountered as they've attempted to explain the origin of biological information in different ways. The first approach is what's called chance. Lots of scientists, especially early on in the 1950s, 1960s, thought that this could solve the problem of the origin of information. Because if you think of a specified sequence, maybe some Scrabble letters arranged to spell something, you could imagine that if you had enough time and trials, and you were shaking the bag around long enough, that randomly they might fall into place. And that was kind of the idea. But the problem with that became very clear, and it became clear in the 60s as scientists began to realize just how enormously complex the DNA molecule was and the protein molecules that are produced by the DNA, just how complex both of those big macromolecules are. And the problem that they identified has acquired a name. It's called the problem of combinatorials. Let's say we're going to try to create a little dinosaur here. I've got a puzzle. I don't know if you can see this. It's got four different dials, six possibilities on each dial. There's a stegosaurus, and the stegosaurus is labeled on one of the dials. There's a tail, a body, and a head. And the idea is you're supposed to turn the puzzle to get all the parts to line up, so you get the stegosaurus parts lined up, the T-Rex parts lined up, and, you know, you get the idea. So the question is, what is the probability of getting the puzzle of cracking the puzzle, of getting it right, if I were to just turn this at random? Well, I've got four dials, six sites. So we've got six possibilities on this dial, and then I've got six on this. So just to get the head and torso correct, how many possibilities do we have? 36, very good. We're tempted, aren't we, to say six plus six possibilities. But it's actually six times six, right? Because every possibility on this dial has six combinations that could go with it. So we've got six times six total possible combinations. If we go to three dials, how many possibilities? Testing your math here. We got some wizards in the audience. Okay, 216. All right, so 216 possibilities. One more dial, and we're up to, I did this beforehand, 1,296 possibilities. Now, you can see what's happening to the number of possibilities. They're not growing in an additive way, are they?
They're growing exponentially, okay? It's actually 6^4 by the time we get out. Now, this is essentially, so you get very big numbers very quickly if you've got a combinatorial system. And this is what you have with both DNA and proteins. Let me illustrate the case with proteins. If you've got 10 sites where the amino acids are linked together, that represents a huge number of corresponding possible arrangements. All right? You've got at each site along the growing chain 20 possible protein-forming amino acids that could figure in. There's actually about 250 amino acids total, but we're just going to set aside the non-protein-forming ones for sake of argument. If we just consider the protein-forming amino acids that are possible, you've got 20 times 20 times 20 times 20 possibilities out 10 places, which is 10^10, or 10 trillion possible combinations. Okay, do you see? This is the problem of combinatorials. Now, proteins are typically about 300 amino acids. That's an average length. There are shorter proteins, but if we look at one of about half of that, just a very modest length protein of 150 amino acids, you see that the number of possible combinations of amino acids just becomes enormous very quickly. It would be 10^150, or 1 in 10^195. Okay, very, very big numbers. Now, if we go back to my little illustration, where'd my dino thing go? There, here we go. Okay, let me just run a thought experiment by you. If I ask you, what are the odds of cracking the puzzle? You could say, well, the odds are 1 chance in 1296, we said. But we also have to take into account how many different trials you might have. And so let's say I'm going to give you four tries. Is it more likely or less likely than not that you would crack the puzzle if I only give you four trials and you've got 1296 possibilities to search? It's going to be less, right? It's less likely than not that you'll crack it, okay? In other words, to make a judgment about whether or not chance is a plausible explanation, you have to know something about what my colleague Bill Dembski calls the probabilistic resources, the number of tries you're going to get to crack the puzzle. Well, the problem in the case of proteins is that the combinatorial complexity of even a single short protein vastly exceeds the number of events that have taken place since the Big Bang, such that it's much like only being given 2 or 3 tries to crack the dinosaur puzzle. It's always going to be much more likely than not that an undirected search would stumble on one of the few functional sequences among the vast combination of all the possibilities. Now, I haven't put the exact numbers here. I made a much more precise calculation in the book, but I want to just illustrate this conceptually. There's a different set of numbers in the book. There's a number of factors that you have to analyze to get a precise estimate of the probability of finding one protein by chance. And I take all those factors into account. But essentially, the problem is the same problem as trying to crack this puzzle with only a few tries at your disposal. All the events since the Big Bang represent a very minuscule fraction in relation to the number of combinations that have to be searched. And that's the problem of chance. And so as a result of that, most scientists, in fact, I don't know of any scientist today who's working seriously on the origin of life who thinks that chance represents a reasonable explanation for the origin of biological information. Here's one who says that blind chance is very limited. It can produce low levels of cooperation exceedingly easily, the equivalent of small words or letters, but chance becomes very quickly incompetent as the amount of organization or information is required. I used to do an illustration when I was in teaching college where I'd pass around a bag of Scrabble letters and have students pick letters out at random and then go put them on the chalkboard to see how much functionally specified information they could produce by chance alone. Always you'd get gibberish on the board very quickly. Okay, and that's what this scientist is saying. So chance is not the way to go. But many scientists have taken a classically Darwinian approach and try to explain the origin of information. They've realized, in Darwin's view, his mechanism involved both chance and natural selection working in tandem. And so some scientists have said, well, maybe we should invoke natural selection acting at the prebiotic level, before we have life, to explain the origin of the information that you need to get life. But there's a problem with this. And the problem has to do with what you need to get natural selection going. Natural selection requires, if you think about it in the Darwinian sense, it's the idea of differential survival and competition among organisms in the next generation. If you get a new trait that arises, it's passed on to the next generation if it confers a survival advantage. But all that presupposes you have living organisms that can reproduce themselves, create offspring which can compete with each other, and then decide, in essence, through that process, which traits will get passed on. So natural selection presupposes the existence of self-replicating organisms. But self-replication in organisms is transacted as the result of the existence of DNA and proteins. DNA replication is part of the process of cell division and so forth. And so if you're going to have natural selection, you've got to have self-replicating organisms, which in turn presupposes the existence of information-rich DNA and proteins. What were we trying to explain the origin of? The origin of DNA and proteins, in particular, the information in them. So this is what in logic is known as a question-begging explanation. Okay, it presupposes the very thing that we're trying to explain in the first place. I have an illustration of the problem that I've shared with students. You got a guy who's walking home from work. He's not paying attention to where he's going. He must be a philosopher of science. And he falls in a big pit. He gets in the pit and he realizes you got 30 feet on each side and he's stuck. And he says, no problem. All I need is a ladder. So he goes home, he gets a ladder, comes back in, jumps in the pit and climbs out. Okay. Obviously begs the question as to how he got out of the pit to get the ladder to solve the problem. The proposal of prebiotic natural selection does essentially the same thing. One Nobel Prize winning biochemist who works on the problem of the origin of life has put it this way. He says, theories of prebiotic natural selection need information, which implies they have to presuppose what is to be explained in the first place. Now, there are other proposals, more contemporary versions of these proposals. These were first made in the 60s. And in particular, the idea of RNA world tries to lower the threshold to get evolution going. Instead of a self-replicating organism, it proposes just a self-replicating molecule or system of molecules. In my book, I have a whole chapter on this proposal called the RNA world, and I give a very detailed critique of its many problems. If you'd like to know more about that, you can look to the book on that. A third broad explanatory approach to explaining the origin of information has been the idea of self-organization, or relying on processes of necessity or law. And this idea was actually the idea that had been proposed by Dean Kenyon, the scientist I mentioned who repudiated his own theory in the mid-80s. His idea was kind of based on something that's intuitive from chemistry, that there are arrangements of molecules that are highly ordered that are the result of physical and chemical forces. For example, the crystal of salt. The Na has a plus charge, the Cl a minus charge. There's an attraction, a bond that forms, and in a solution of those the Na's and the Cl's, you'll form nice, rigid, orderly crystals. And voila, you have no design, no chance. It's essentially a very organized, law-like process that produces an organization of elements. And he proposed that that type of process might be responsible for the origin of the information in DNA. Actually, the origin of the arrangement of amino acids and proteins. He hoped something like that might pan out for DNA as well. But as he began to reflect on the problem, he realized that on his own proposal, he realized it wouldn't work. First of all, he realized that the proteins are built from DNA. So even if this did work for proteins, and there's real problems with this proposal for proteins, he had to also make it work for DNA. But in the case of DNA, it was clear that it couldn't work. And you can see this if you look at the chemical structure of DNA on the PowerPoint screen here. On the outside of the molecule here, you have the sugar phosphate backbone. On the interior of the molecule, you have the bases, the ACs, Gs, and Ts. The information is carried in this vertical axis. And if you notice carefully, remember the idea of self-organization was that you get chemical bonds that would form that would cause the constituent parts of the molecule to arrange themselves in a particular way. Notice along the spine of the DNA molecule, there are no bonds between the ACs, Gs, and Ts in this vertical axis. In other words, there's no chemistry that is forcing the arrangement of those characters in the way that Kenyon had hoped or anticipated. In addition, where there is a bond between the base and this sugar phosphate backbone, it's the same type of bond in each case. For chemists, it's called an N-glycosidic bond. And what it does is it allows any one of the four bases to attach to this backbone at any site. So the chemistry does not force any particular arrangement of characters. Now, I have a little illustration, again, that makes this a little more accessible for non-chemists. Got a message here pandering to the local audience, although maybe not here at Heritage. I don't know if Heritage folks think D.C. actually rocks right now. But the idea is, this is a metal chalkboard. You've got little magnetic letters. There's a force of attraction that causes the letters to stick to the backboard. Okay, the backboard is like the backbone in my analogy, in my chemical analogy. And the idea here is that the force of magnetic attraction is not responsible. You can see clearly it's not responsible for the arrangement of characters that constituted this short message I had here. What is responsible? Actually, in this case, it's a mind. It's an intelligence. And this is the intuition that was circulating among some of the scientists who were first interested in intelligent design, that information is a product, a hallmark of mind. And my story is that when I set off to graduate school, I wanted to find out if that intuition could be made into a rigorous scientific hypothesis. It's intuitive, but could it be made scientific? And so one of the things I did, I mean, I studied these different approaches, and I found that chance, necessity, self-organization, each one of them failed to explain the origin of information. But I wondered, was there any, you know, force to the idea, logic to the idea, that intelligent design could provide a rigorous scientific explanation of this critical phenomenon, the origin of information? So I began to study the method of Darwin and the way he studied the remote past, the way he pioneered this scientific method for studying events in the remote past. And it turns out he uses a method called inference to the best explanation. And he hints at it here, where he says that he's inferring his view of evolutionary theory until some better hypothesis comes along. The method is inherently comparative. What you're trying to do is infer a cause which will explain the event you're trying to infer a cause that could explain the event, some event in the remote past. We're trying to explain the origin of life, the origin of the information that's necessary. So the idea is you look at different possible causes, and I've been doing that so far, looking at causes based on chance, based on necessity, and the combination of the two. And the idea when you're using this method is you're trying to infer that explanation, which, if true, would best explain the event. But the question arose, what constitutes the best explanation? How do we know when a cause constitutes the best explanation? Well, it turns out that both Darwin and his scientific mentor, Lyell, or one of his mentors, had a simple commonsensical rule of reasoning that they used, and it was just this: that if you're trying to infer events in the remote past, you should infer a cause which is known to produce the event or effect you're trying to explain. Sounds simple enough. In eastern Washington, we've got a big fat layer of ash. We would, using their rule of method, infer not the earthquake hypothesis, but rather the volcanic eruption hypothesis, because we know that volcanoes are known to produce volcanic ash layers, whereas earthquakes are not. The way Lyell put it, he said, the good historical scientist is looking for causes now in operation or presently acting causes, causes that are known to produce the effect in question. And as I began to investigate how this method was used in science, I asked myself a question. What is the cause now in operation, the cause that we know from our uniform and repeated experience, another of Lyell's dictums, that produces information? What cause, based on our experience, do we know is capable of producing information? And I knew there was only one. In fact, I'd investigated the other failed attempts. But I knew from experience, from our ordinary experience, and also some scientific experience, that intelligence is capable of producing information, but no other cause is. And this idea was reinforced by something I read in an early one of the molecular biologists who was a pioneer in applying information theory to molecular biology, is Henry Quassler. In the 60s, he says, the creation of information is habitually associated with conscious activity. And of course, we know that's true. If you look at a newspaper headline,
or a hieroglyphic inscription, or a section of software in a computer code, and you trace that information back to its source, you inevitably come to a mind, not a material process. That's what we know from our uniform and repeated experience, the basis of all scientific reasoning about the past. So when we find information in the DNA molecule encoded in this functionally specified way, the most logical thing to conclude using this scientific method that Darwin himself pioneered is that intelligence played a role in the origin of the information necessary to produce life. So I concluded that, in fact, it is possible to make a scientific case for intelligent design. That's what my book does. I use this method of multiple competing hypotheses or inferring to the best explanation. I have examined this question of the origin of the information necessary to build life, and then I look at the competing classes of explanations, those based on chance, necessity, the combination of the two, and infer that there is only one known cause for the origin of information, and therefore the best thing to infer, the best explanation of that information, is intelligent design. That's the argument I present in The Signature in the Cell. I've presented it today based essentially on Molecular Biology 101. But in the book, I look at some other more recent discoveries about the informational properties of the cell, things that have come out of the genome projects, and especially the recent discoveries under the heading of the ENCODE project, and look at some other fascinating evidences of design in the way that the information in DNA is organized in files within folders, folders within superfolders. There's a hierarchical filing system in DNA. There's an error correction, essentially a spell check system within the cell. There is also a way of storing information that's very much like the data storage systems in modern digital computers. It's a storage and retrieval system that's distributed. It's a fascinating system, the whole information processing system in the cell. So I think there are many other evidences of design other than just the simple linear array of code, but that's a good enough place to start. So that's the argument of the book, and I'd be grateful for any questions and comments as we conclude here. Yes, in the back.
Science in the past has had huge gaps, and they've closed those gaps. So what's the big deal here? Just give science a little time.
That is a very common objection to the case I've made. I have a fairly extensive attempted refutation, in one of the latter chapters of my book, Chapter 17. Let me represent the objection symbolically. Because I think it's clear, it's important to be clear about what's going on. The God of the gaps argument is essentially the claim that we're inferring design because of a gap in our scientific knowledge, because of what we don't know, our ignorance. Logically, there's a fallacy called the argument from ignorance, and it would be we could illustrate it with a political example. We could say, well, a conservative would say John Kerry has all these bad qualities, therefore he would be a bad president. Therefore, George Bush would be a good president. Okay, but that's an argument from ignorance. To make a good argument for George Bush's presidency, you would have to give some positive reasons for believing that Bush is a good president. We're accused of making an argument very much like that, saying, well, natural processes can't produce the effect in question. In this case, the digital information necessary to get life going. Therefore, ID or God or some intelligent agent did it. But that's not actually how we're arguing. We're arguing like this. We're saying natural processes cannot produce or have not produced the effect in question, digital information, but there is a kind of cause which is known to produce that effect. That kind of cause is intelligence, and therefore intelligent design, mind, is the best explanation among the contenders that are on the table. And this is a classic scientific style of reasoning. It's not fallacious logically. It's provisional. If new evidence came along that suggested there was some cause that was as good or better, then we'd have to look at that. But the argument as formulated is not an argument from ignorance. Therefore, it's not a God of the gaps argument. And that's my answer.
So You suggest that using current examples like computer code that we've produced, our minds have produced, is an example of producing digital information. Obviously, when this happened in the primordial ooze with DNA or protein, it wasn't our minds doing it. Do you speculate as to the nature of this intelligence, where that intelligence came from, how that intelligence evolved? I mean, I know Richard Dawkins makes the argument that because of what we know about evolution, a greater intelligence would have to come from a lesser one, or a greater, kind of more complex life form, would have to come from a lesser complex life form. So where did this great, obviously very complex, obviously very intelligent mind come from so as to create, you know, DNA?
Yeah, excellent question. Dawkins formulates an objection by saying, well, then who designed the designer? And if you have to answer that with another postulation of a designer, then you've got an infinite regress. Well, there's basically two possibilities. Either the designing intelligence is imminent within the universe. Francis Crick was at least toyed with that idea with his panspermia hypothesis, that life was seeded here on Earth from intelligent beings in space. Or there's the idea that the intelligence is transcendent, that it is from beyond the universe, something more like God. So in brief, aliens or God. I myself favor the God hypothesis, but I acknowledge that from the biology alone, you have to leave open both of those two possibilities. I favor the God hypothesis for a number of reasons, but scientifically speaking, I think there's also other evidence of design that has to be reckoned with, in particular the fine-tuning that exists from the very beginning of the universe. And I'm also very impressed with the current versions of the cosmological argument that are based on the observation that the universe begins at a singularity and that the universe is not eternal and self-existent, which I think actually also helps to answer Dawkins' objection. I think in any worldview or system of thought, you have to answer, every system of thought has the same problem. It has to answer the question, what is the prime reality? What is the thing from which everything else comes? And I think post-new cosmology, Big Bang theory, materialism is a very crummy candidate to be, you know, matter and energy, rather, or a crummy candidate to be the thing from which everything else comes. So I think it's a more plausible system overall. Theism provides a more plausible overall explanatory system for taking into account these big developments in science, the new evidence concerning the origin of the universe, the fine-tuning of the universe, as well as evidence of design in biology someplace down the timeline. Got one more in the back, if I could, Becky.
All right, then I'll yield.
Yeah.
What do Dawkins and Dennett say in response to your comments about the origin of life?
Well, Dawkins is interesting. I mean, he's not known for reticence in defending evolutionary theory, but he acknowledged, at least in the end of the Expelled movie, when he was being interviewed by Ben Stein, that, quote, no one knows, and I think he was talking from within an evolutionary framework, how life first originated. So I don't, my claim that intelligent design is the best explanation is not usually refuted by people saying, well, we have a better answer at this point. There's general agreement that there is no adequate explanation for the origin of the first life. What people will typically try to say instead is, well, you can't consider intelligent design because it violates the rules of science. It's not scientific. But our response to that is to say that the primary obligation of the scientist is to follow the evidence wherever it leads to the best causal explanation, irrespective of whether that points to intelligence or a materialistic answer. So, thank you. Sorry.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Dr. Meyer. Again, a provocative and interesting discussion. We have these books available for sale for anyone who would like to purchase it, read it, and engage him in more discussion. I'm sure that he would be delighted to have an online discussion or debate with anyone here who has purchased the book and wants to pursue that. We are grateful that you took time out of your day to come today. Thank you, Dr. Meyer, and thank you all very much. I believe we have some lunch to serve to you outside.